Aloha, Rick Sengaria, Vermont Edition. This podcast has been edited for brevity, so enjoy. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The legislature is back in session today, trying to tie up loose ends and hoping to end the session in the next couple of days. But the big sticking point, or the thing that prevented lawmakers from adjourning last week, is an issue over state versus local control. Yes, that constant tension in Vermont has come back in the form of teacher health care plans and who should be negotiating them. Governor Phil Scott believes there should be a statewide teacher health care plan and that savings from this plan, up to $26 million, he says, should go back to the taxpayers. Democratic leaders agree that taxpayers should see some relief from a lowering in the cost of teacher health care plans. They all need to be changed this year. But these Democrats believe that those savings can be accomplished without moving to a statewide plan. They argue that school boards and teachers should continue to be able to negotiate at the local level. On Monday on this program, we spoke with House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, who outlined why she believes that to be the best course of action and how she hopes the Senate and House can come together this week. And today, to have this conversation again, but in a different way, it's kind of like Groundhog Day, is Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash. Welcome back to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Jane.
And thanks for making time for us today. What's actually been happening this morning as lawmakers are back in the State House?
Well, there's a lot of getting to know yous again since we've delayed coming back until this time this week. Normally, we're back earlier in the week. And we tidied up some bills that had been left hanging, the kind of bills that are each very important in their own way. But at the end of the session, sometimes we forget about these important policies which will improve people's lives but aren't getting all the headlines. So,
want to tick off those topics then for us?
Well, this morning we passed a change in the way telemedicine is performed in the state, allowing more medical services that are appropriate to be delivered remotely using technology, which will improve access for people who have difficulty accessing care or in areas of the state where there aren't many doctors providing particular services. And possibly saving money. That's our hope in the long run, is that it will actually help drive down costs. So it's one of those areas of policy which we fought like heck for 2 months. And then at the end of the session, we have to remind ourselves how important it is, even in light of these other larger sticking points at the end.
So as you said, you've been tidying up some bills and doing some procedural stuff, but not getting into a floor debate, for example, on teacher health care plans. Have there been conversations that have been happening in an ad hoc sort of fashion, either between senators or among senators and House members in the days since Friday night when you took that pause?
Well, there have been discussions like that really since the House vote, that famous 74-74 tie vote, which threw this issue into a bit of turbulence. And in the Senate, I can speak for our members, the conversation has never been about not achieving a maximum amount of savings for taxpayers. That is just the first and foremost piece. Unlike the governor, we don't have a press spokesperson. We don't do press conferences and press releases every day. So when the public keeps hearing, why won't the legislature give back that $26 million, it's a very silly proposition. We agree with the governor that we should achieve as much of that money as possible. So how you achieve those savings has really been the sticking point, as you noted in your opening. And the governor's proposal would jump into the collective bargaining process. And many listeners might say, oh, collective bargaining, it sounds like some legal technical thing that like a labor lawyer would really care about. But every workplace situation, when someone signs up to work somewhere, there are some trade-offs. You have a certain salary, you have certain benefits, hopefully, days off. All those different things are in the mix. And really, when you make the decision about working there, whether you're in a union or not, you've considered that whole, that balancing act of those trade-offs that you have. You maybe didn't have as high a salary, but you get these great benefits, or vice versa. The governor's proposal would just step in and deal with one of them and is silent about all the rest. So the governor has said that, well, depending on which day, some days it's we're going to save $26 million. Sometimes it's up to $26 million. But in all of the proposals the governor and his allies have put forward to date, there is no guarantee there's a single penny of savings. So,
which we should say is true about what the House and Senate Democrats would like to do. There's no guarantee that there are up to $26 million in savings for taxpayers, regardless of which plan.
That is exactly correct, which is why we've been very careful to say up to $26 million, which is a number that's been identified. But we've been hearing different things from the executive branch. It seems like a hard and fast number. So in the Senate, we've been having those conversations. But one of the things we thought was very important, and of course, we will get accused of being, you know, patsies for the big bad teachers union, you know, all those music teachers who are telling us what to do with, big thick, work boots, and they're, giving us orders. But what we have said is that, look, like it or not, and whether you're supportive of the teachers union or not, we have thousands of teachers all across the state who will be going back into the classroom this fall. And the best way to make sure everyone wins in this situation is to at least invite them to have some role in the discussions about this issue. Up until this week, the teachers had never been included in a discussion about this proposal from the administration, except when the proposal was dropped just over 2 weeks ago.
And now the teachers have had a chance, the NEA has had a chance to speak with the governor?
Well, I'd let them speak for themselves. I believe they've had at least an initial conversation. And to me, that's important. The governor needs to hear directly from the teachers. Again, even if they disagree about what the resolution should be, you can't ignore the 40,000 or so, or however many covered lives there are, that will be affected by this proposal. And I understand the desire to make school board members' lives easier in negotiating, but that doesn't mean you ignore the situation that the other 40,000 people on the other side of the table are going to experience.
So I think my original question to you was, have you been having conversations among yourselves as lawmakers, and have you been reaching into the other chamber to try to have conversations with House members so that there can be some resolution? It sounds almost like what you were answering was your pitch to Vermonters. I mean, who are you trying to sell on this right now? Because doesn't this all have to happen in the State House at this very moment?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry I felt like a salesperson there. But it's really a message both to the public, to the Senate, and to the House, and to the administration. So
you are trying to talk to House members right now, too?
We have been speaking with members of the House. And so me, the Speaker, and others have been trying to figure out what the options are before us. And I'll just say, there's a reason why it's been elusive so far. This is not simple business. A policy change like this under normal circumstances would be introduced in January, and people would fight about it for 4 or 5 months, and we would work through all the details. We're still learning about the details of this proposal. So we're all under some duress because of the timing of the announced proposal.
So then why isn't it just a non-starter? Because you don't have the votes to override a veto should the governor decide to veto it? I mean, much of a problem, why isn't it something that lawmakers are saying, bring this up next year? We're not talking about it this year.
Well, this is just cold numbers, not salesmanship. The House has 53 Republicans, I believe. I could be off by one or two, and a number of others who have said that they will not vote to override a governor's veto. And the governor has said he will veto it if this $26 million is not in there. So, there's just the reality that imposes on the process. We could invite a veto. We'd be right back here a month from now, and no one would be better off, including the public.
Is that why you essentially and the Senate decided to stop on Friday evening and say, let's have some conversations. Let's figure out a way around this. And instead of adjourning on Saturday, let's come back on Wednesday and Thursday and have this discussion again and see if there's a compromise that can also work for the governor.
Well, Jane, anybody who's had surgery and has had any anesthesia, the doctor usually says don't make any decisions in the next 24 hours. It's kind of like being in the legislature at the end of the session. People are stressed, tired. They've been thinking about 100 different things. And then plop this big sea change proposal in. And I, at the end of last week, I pulled in some people from the Senate and said, look, where do you think things stand? And would it be productive for us to keep plowing through on Saturday? Unanimously, the sentiment was, you know what? It would be helpful for everyone involved if we took a breather, let a few days distance, allow us to come back and look at this fresh. Because as I've said, I believe on your program earlier in the year, my goal in the end is to shake the hand of the governor and the speaker at the end of the day and not have vetoes and not have conflict. I still think that's possible, but we can't operate under a false sense of timing. I have watched the legislature make horrific decisions in the interest of adjourning in one day, and we all come to regret it. And so I'd rather take the extra couple days, get it right, have people feel comfortable when they go back and tell the public what they've done.
Emily in Bennington emailed in to say, I'm a teacher and I take great offense at teachers' health care being described as Cadillac in any way. Teacher benefits being described as out of proportion is just not accurate. If getting reasonable health care, and sometimes my plan does not even feel like reasonable coverage for my family, if that for anyone seems like an indulgence, then we really need to change the conversation dramatically. Everyone deserves good health care. Let's quit harping on this issue for teachers. And what Emily's getting into there is partly this question of how much could we see in savings for taxpayers, that up to $26 million figure that we keep hearing about, because teacher health care plans have to be renegotiated, that they all have to be renegotiated. And the question is, in some ways, who's going to be paying more and how does that sugar out? And so that then gets to the question of who's doing those negotiations, because if the statewide contract is in place for teacher health care, then all of the teachers are getting that same package across the board, at least as far as health care is concerned. Although, Senator Ash, as you said, there are other parts of the benefit package that would be negotiated still at the local level. If it's all done at the local level, there's a really uneven distribution in how those would work. And my understanding is that if the legislature does nothing, it's up to each district how they want to use that potential savings. So do they want to return it to property taxpayers? Do they want to use it for some fund within their school system? So this compromise that you think you can work out with the House and with the governor to make sure that taxpayers are getting some amount of money yet to be determined, what would that look like? What do you think will actually pass muster with lawmakers and still avoid a gubernatorial veto?
Well, there are a number of possible approaches, and each one offends a different constituency. The simplest mechanism, in my opinion, that guarantees a return to taxpayers is you basically identify the savings target. The governor has put out $26 million. You identify, using some formula, how much each district should negotiate to for their health benefit to make their contribution, if you will, toward that $26 million, and then that comes out of their ed fund payment. That will alienate both the teachers and the school boards, but it's very simple and it guarantees the savings. It's the simplest. You could, and we've heard this publicly stated, you could put in statute for a period of time which plan all the teachers will have. But again, that has its problem, because at the local negotiating table, it will just put all that heat of the negotiation on salary increases, or, you know, from the teacher's point of view, and the boards would be fighting that. You could create a new negotiating structure, which is really the underpinning of the governor's plan. The dilemma there is it introduces all sorts of new unintended consequences. What if the governor and the teachers don't reach agreement? How long does that go on? All the local negotiating will stall in the meantime, because they have to wait to see what the healthcare benefit's going to be. So then their ramp up of negotiations around salary will wait until the fall. So we would have essentially a statewide situation where teachers are working for months into the next school year, everybody without a contract in place except the handful that have already settled. So each has its disadvantage. And I think everyone understands there's going to be some concessions made here. I, for one, am someone who has been a critic of the total amount we spend on education, not because I'm anti-education. I think we can have a more efficient system. That said, I strongly believe that you don't meddle into collective bargaining negotiations, especially in real time, which is what this represents. I understand with the new landscape of the House vote that the teachers and others are going to have to accept that there might be some incursion into the purity of that process. On the other hand, the governor has said $26 million is the number. While privately, everyone acknowledges there's no chance that that full $26 million will be realized under any of the proposals. So there's going to have to be some yielding there. The hardest part is the legislature does not have the bully pulpit of going out there. Right now, if you're the average person out there and you've been listening to talk radio programs or reading the paper, what you're hearing is from the governor's office, why won't they give you your $26 million back? From the legislature, you're hearing, well, it's actually really complicated. There'll be all these unintended consequences, and we start geeking out fast. Well, I think the first message is more persuasive, even if it doesn't really have all the facts behind it.
But you said a few minutes ago that you do think that a compromise can be reached, and I am not hearing where that is in those plans that you laid out. Because as you said, they each offend someone, and the governor has not said the word veto, But he's also said he wants to see that those savings realized, and there's that underlying message that, you know, lawmakers are well aware of, that there could be a veto. I mean, where is the compromise? Where do you see that actually happening?
Well, in each of the constituencies being offended, including the legislature that I just described, that compromise is in each of those concessions being on the table as part of the final package. I mean, I can't negotiate it on air here with you, Jane, although it would be fun and you're very knowledgeable.
Go for it. I'm ready.
but in truth, you know, those are the discussions that are starting to mature.
You really do think that everybody will be able to come together and hold hands sometime tomorrow, maybe?
Whether I don't care if it's tomorrow. I care that it be the right decision. I do think an agreement can be had here. Yes.
What are you willing to give up?
Well, what I am willing to do is to be more aggressive in terms of the legislature and the executive branch communicating to school districts and their negotiating partner, the teachers, that there will be savings, period. And I agree that taxpayers should be one of the beneficiaries of the transition of these new health plans. And so I'm ready to stand behind that. The manner of doing it has become really the sticking point.
Yeah.
And frankly, every negotiation gets to a finish line or an impasse. I don't think any of us are interested in an impasse between the governor and the legislature. But this doesn't come together simply or quickly as much as people would like it to. If this had been proposed in January, we would be all wiping our hands of this. It would be done. We would have figured out the path. So we're trying to make complicated trade-offs in a very compressed period of time, trying to avoid all the unintended consequences that I think we'd all come to regret.
Let's go to Barb, who's calling in from Waterbury. Hi, Barb. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is about the consistency of the health care coverage and costs, both within school districts across the state and also if you compare that to the average Vermonter and their kind of health care costs. I would love to see that covered in the discussion. And I agree that this is too quick to happen this legislative session. And I would urge the governor, if he is listening, to back off, compromise, and have it not veto it and go into the next legislative session. Thank
Barb,
you.
Thanks for the call. And, Governor, if you are listening, feel free to call in, because I am certainly not going to characterize your position. But one of the unique things that's happening right now is this renegotiation of teacher health care contracts across the board, which does not usually happen. Every teacher health care contract needs to be renegotiated. It has to be brought in out of the plans that they currently have and into the established plans on the health exchange. And that's one of the reasons why this particular moment is a crucial time. But Senator Ash, to Barb's point about, could it mean a greater or lesser degree of coverage or benefits for teachers in each individual district? And how does that compare to the regular Vermonters' health care package?
Well,
there is such a thing.
The first question is, if there was this statewide negotiated health benefit from the governor, it didn't speak to the full range of payments and out-of-pocket expenses of teachers. So you could still have variation from district to district on how much the actual teacher has to pay when you count up all the out-of-pocket expenses for them. So it simplifies one piece of the healthcare negotiation but leaves some others out there. So you would have variation. But the larger question about whether teachers in general enjoy a more complete or generous or rich healthcare benefit than your average Vermonter or average employee, the short answer is yes. I'll leave that to others to decide whether it's too generous for teachers, not generous enough, or just right. It's the result of decades of decision-making by local school districts.
So teachers have a more generous benefits, healthcare benefits package than who? Than private employers, employees?
Well,
I mean, isn't it so variable that it's difficult
to say? I can't make a hard and fast rule. I will make an educated guess that the average employed Vermonter does not have a healthcare benefit that is as generous as what the average teacher in Vermont has. And there's variation even amongst teachers in the public school system. So it's not about, I'm not speaking with expertise on every single, employer situation. But in general, it is viewed as a rich plan, which gets to some of the political challenge the teachers face, which is, and the same is true of the state employees, where people in the old days, the salary of teachers and public employees was relatively low compared to their private sector peers, but their benefits and job security were greater, and that was the trade-off. Well, as the economy around us has changed, the teachers in many cases have the salary that's still very competitive now and the benefits. So the situation, the dynamic has really changed, and it's one of the reasons you hear some grievance from taxpayers saying, well, wait a sec, how come they get such a good deal and I'm always the one who has to keep paying more for it?
Yeah, and back to Emily in Bennington who emailed, who says, you know, this is a bigger conversation about healthcare needs for everybody rather than one that she thinks should be pinned on teachers having what's often described as a Cadillac plan. And that's actually been described that way technically at the federal government level. It's not just a colloquial expression here. Let's go to Jack, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking the call. The question that keeps puzzling me is, and this is not just for Senator Ash, but also for Speaker Johnson, why in the face of decades of failure on the part of local boards, and I was one of those board members, to reel in the cost of benefits and provide teachers with the normative benefit that most all taxpayers are subject to, because that is defined in surveys. Why do you believe the boards can and will do this now? It seems that that evidence suggests only the contrary will result. And then secondly, why if school consolidation could be passed by the legislature without any evidence that savings could be defined at the time of passage, why is it so important to define to the penny what the resulting benefit will be now? We didn't do that before, so why is it so important now? Thank you.
Jack, thanks for the call. Senator Ash?
Well, the second question I'll take first. The to-the-penny question of why is it that we have to identify some target number, I'll just say the short answer is because the governor has said he'd either in these words exactly or by implication veto the budget if it's not a $26 million or up to $26 million or some expression. And so I think that both the House and Senate were prepared to support language which said let the boards produce savings through their negotiations and let that money trickle back to benefit the taxpayer. That was not viewed as sufficiently aggressive to get to that precise number, but really – that's what's going on there. And in truth, you know, the first question is a very good one and about why would we believe that after all these years that suddenly districts will be more successful, if you will, bringing the benefits down to some other level. And I think there's really two responses. One is it implies that the thing we should do is reduce the benefits down to what surveys show is some average plan. We would have to take into consideration salary and all the other pieces of that puzzle. The second is really if there is a discussion about taking this off the local level, these healthcare negotiations, most members of the Senate and I think most members of the House I've spoken to have said we're open to that discussion, but to force this quick choice on us at the very end of the session, we don't have confidence that either the governor or we will get it right. So let's have that discussion when we're not under duress. And that can begin as soon as in the off season. We could be having, you know, commission meetings or doing something with the governor. But that's secondary to getting some savings in the meantime. So I think we're open to the discussion. We've said that out loud. We've told the governor directly. So I guess, Jack, in the short term, I'm not sure that it would produce the results that that some are hoping for. But to fundamentally uproot the whole system is something that we think begs more than 2 weeks of discussion.
Today on the program, we're talking with Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash. In his acceptance speech in January, Ash spoke of two Vermonts. One Vermont where people are well-educated, have skills valued by employers, and are able to enjoy the outdoors, culture, and wonderful food the state offers. Then he described what he sees as the other Vermont.
The other Vermont is inhabited by people experiencing a very different kind of life. In this other Vermont, global trade has forced the shutdown of longtime factories that used to guarantee a well-paying job for someone who just had a high school diploma, and that's especially true in rural areas. The other Vermont has kids growing up in families racked with drug or alcohol or mental health problems or some combination of the three. In the other Vermont, people receive small paychecks and have few options for healthy living and can't take their kids anywhere for enrichment. The other Vermont is filled with people who have been at best holding the line, but more likely have been losing a little economic ground in the decade past that has benefited some so greatly.
Ash went on to say that the charge of the Senate in every policy area is to create one Vermont. Senator Ash, do you see any progress in bringing those two Vermonts together that you can point to in your first part of your first term as Senate President Pro Tem?
Yeah, I think one area of particular pride, and this originated in our Senate Health and Welfare Committee and Senator Clarier in particular, working with our Appropriations Committee, we've made a substantial increase in the investment in our mental health system, but not in putting up a new building, which we don't know that we need that, but investing in the people who are the frontline workforce. We have a sea of people who have the most amazingly difficult jobs working with people with either acute mental health needs or ongoing needs who have been really – the system has been riding their backs, they making 12, 13 bucks an hour for jobs that are often very dangerous. And we have we basically have created a two-step process, and this year we're funding the first step to get those people up to a minimum of 14 bucks an hour, and then also making investments in some of the key acute nursing positions so that we can both properly compensate them, reduce turnover, and increase the retention of people into that very important field. That, to me, is a really critical thing, because the irony is these people are doing unthinkably difficult jobs, and they're collecting public benefits because they're getting paid so little. So that is an area that I'm very proud of. We are very close to the finish line on a housing bond. Early in the session, I said we'd be working closely with the governor and with the speaker and all of our respective team members, and that is precisely what's happened. We haven't quite signed on the dotted line, but we're pretty close to making a substantial investment at housing, new housing at all income levels. So we'll be creating both new housing for people who don't have a lot of financial means, but also freeing up some space as some people can move into the slightly more expensive housing. Those are two areas in particular. And then the third, and this is one of those, I'll call it halftime score issues. To me, the single most important thing we can do to improve people's well-being is get more money in their paychecks. And we have a minimum wage that has one more step increase to do under an earlier piece of legislation. So it'll go up to, I believe, $10.50 next January. I don't think anyone in the Senate – well, I shouldn't say that. I think the majority of members of the Senate believe that is insufficient and that we need to really strengthen our minimum wage law, but do it in a way that doesn't have consequences that we're not quite expecting. So we've been evaluating the benefits issues that are related to getting more money in your pocket. We don't want to, on the one hand, give someone a buck more in pay and then see them lose a buck 50 in benefits, because then they're probably not going to feel a heck of a lot of incentive to go to work. So what we have said is that when we come back in January, the first major policy vote will be on an increase of the minimum wage, and we'll try to be thinking a little bit more broadly as part of an anti-poverty strategy. But to me, the commitment we've made to that will show itself next year in January.
Let's go to Paul, who's calling in from West Charleston. Hi, Paul. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just had a comment. There's been a lot of talk about the legalization of recreational marijuana, and that keeps getting pushed to the back burner because they keep saying they need to balance the budget first. But if they would legalize and tax that, there's a huge tax revenue that's being ignored that would, you know, help pay for schools, food. I mean, when you look out at the Colorado and the other states, the amount of taxes being brought in is huge. And I know there's a lot to sort out and a lot to fine-tune with that system, but that's a huge amount of money being ignored by the state of Vermont because they keep saying, oh, we need to balance the budget first. And that could be a huge windfall for the state if you guys can figure that out.
Paul, it's interesting that you bring up marijuana legalization, because that has been the bill that, at least in my mind, has probably had the most ups and downs, the never going to happens, and we're close to passing. We're passing something. And as of today, it actually looks like a marijuana legalization bill might happen this session. But my understanding, Senator Ash, is that the approach that looks likely to make it all the way through is it would legalize small amounts of homegrown marijuana, legalize the consumption of marijuana, but it would not create what Paul is talking about with this commercial and taxable framework. Instead, a special commission will study how to create a regulated system for the state. What can you tell us about the likelihood that this is actually going to happen and how you feel about it?
Well, the Senate, as some of your listeners may know, last year spent a considerable amount of time understanding how we would move forward with a tax and regulate system that would control it like hard alcohol and have funds available for education and for increased law enforcement recognition programs and so on. The House did not favor that at the time, and so last year was yet another year where nothing really changed. This year, the House was to take the lead, and you know, things have. It's been like watching a a cat watching a ping pong game. It feels like, and even in the legislation we passed last year, we called it the go slow tax and regulate approach, which meant everything didn't get triggered immediately. The first thing that would happen would be rulemaking and the establishment of licensing for people to grow and to sell. And then many other decisions were actually put off for a commission to look at. Well, we're realists and understand that if we continue to wait and wait and wait, the terms of this issue will be dictated to us by Canada, by Massachusetts, by Maine. And so what is on the table now is a legalization essentially of personal use, possession, and usage, and a commission to start making progress on how we ought to implement a tax and regulate system. If we do not do that, what we will soon find ourselves facing is people in the southern part of the state driving down to Massachusetts and going and buying it legally and then coming back and using it legally in Vermont. They will be going to Canada and, I don't know, maybe they – I won't get into whether people would sneak it through customs, but
right,
Canada –
which would be completely illegal.
That would be illegal.
That's federal.
And nonetheless, we know the Smuggler's Notch and others, there was a prohibition streamline that went from our north to into Vermont. And people will be going to Maine and possibly and other places. So we can't pretend that the world around us is doing nothing, nor that doing nothing inoculates us from having to react. So we have said from the beginning we wanted to see progress this year, and while we wish it went a little bit further, if it is the House passed legalization of small amounts for personal use and this commission, I think the Senate has said clearly we can live with that if that's the progress we can make.
Which is a change from previous years, because in previous years, it's the two chambers of the legislature that have not been able to come to agreement. But even if both sides here in the State House are able to come to agreement, there's no guarantee, right, that the fifth floor, that the governor will sign that. He has said repeatedly he wants to see a better test, a roadside test for marijuana inebriation. And that obviously hasn't arrived yet.
Yeah, we haven't really got a clear signal from the administration on this one. And, you know, what people from all parties have said out loud in reaction to that concern about people being on the roadways is that people are on the roadways today. I don't know that I believe the RAND report, which suggested that 80,000 Vermonters are using marijuana once a month. But whatever the number is, we know it's in the thousands. And that means people have it in their system at least, whether they're, you know, driving under the influence. Some probably are, and some probably just have it in their system but are not impaired. So this is already an issue on the Vermont roadways. And, you know, I would just ask each of your listeners to put on the reality check cap for a second and say, will suddenly the fact that the legislature and the governor have allowed you to legally possess a small amount of marijuana, is your behavior going to fundamentally change? Are all these people going to start deciding to engage in new reckless behaviors? Because frankly, right now, people who want to access marijuana in Vermont can. And they are. So it's not a question of whether people be on the roadways. It's a question of whether we're ever going to generate the money to do something about it.
All right. So as you said, though, this is okay with you if the actual bill that makes it all the way through legalizes small amounts of possession and has this study commission or this commission to figure out a tax and regulate framework.
The Senate sent it over to the House as our last best way to make some progress this year, and I think they're trying to figure out whether they have the votes to get there.
You've said you don't care how long it takes. You just want to find reasonable compromises. Do you think, though, that the legislative session will end tomorrow, Thursday, or could it stretch later?
I don't mean to treat this lightly, but I don't care.
So you don't care, but is there a likelihood?
If a whole series of things fell into place very quickly, it is possible that we could adjourn tomorrow. That would require a lot to happen in a short period of time. So my attitude is I have always sort of found myself irritated by discussions of the precise adjournment date. I've watched the legislature make million-dollar decisions to save $50,000, and I'm not going to be a part of that.
Lots of bets riding on that decision day, though, that closure.
Well, you can't tell me about that. Otherwise, I might, find myself in an ethical conflict.
Right, and we didn't even get into the Ethics Commission. We'll have to talk about that another time. Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash, thanks very much for joining us on this busy
day. Thank you
day.
So much, Jane.